Welcome back to the Europeans, fresh from celebrating our fifth anniversary in last week's episode. I think we can call ourselves a mature podcast now. The grand dam of the continent, if you will. Although actually, is 5 years old mature? I just realised as I said that like five-year-old humans are not mature.
I think you're going a bit far with the personification of this podcast. I know I complain about personification of various things quite often, but maybe this is just a step too far.
Maybe like, you know how 1 year in human years is like several years in dog years?
Oh, yeah.
We're like 50 in podcast years.
I think that's actually true because I think most podcasts do finish after 3 months. That's not statistically accurate, but something like that.
Something like that. Anyway, we're still here. And Dominic, you are freshly back from Estonia, aren't you?
Yes, I'm rather exhausted after a lovely trip to Tallinn. It was great, although as is often the case with my work trips, I was just basically inside a windowless theater for 3 days.
Yay.
But I did have a very nice time. And I actually, weirdly, there's something about being there, maybe with my lovely colleagues, that I was crying, laughing a lot. I got into a really like hysterical mood and I just had so much fun. Maybe it's because we didn't see any daylight.
Well, it looked very beautiful. I was very jealous of your snowy Instagram posts.
Don't believe anything you saw on Instagram. It was mainly just work. Although we did have time to go to a water park because that was the one thing next to our hotel and we had 2 hours off.
A water park? Like with slides and stuff?
Yeah.
Indoors, I hope, at this time of year in Estonia?
Yes. I recommend it as an adult. It's my first time since being an adult going to a water park and it's still fun.
Amazing.
It was amazing, apart from my jacket was stolen, but let's not talk about that.
Well, on that gloomy note, what have we got coming up on this week's show? I hope it's something that's going to cheer you up.
We'll see about that. We're going to be talking about China this week. We're going to be calling up Yuan Yang, who's from the Financial Times, to talk about the reported existence of these secret Chinese police service stations that are apparently all around the world, outside of China's territory. Many of them are said to be in Europe, and some European governments have been responding to these allegations in recent weeks. Yuan will be joining us later on in the show to help us understand what these secret police service stations are, what they're there for, and to help us understand how concerned we should be about them. That's coming up later, but first it's time for Bad week. Who's had a bad week, Katie?
It's been a bad week for Hungary's relations with its neighbours. And usually it's you who's our reluctant football correspondent, Dominic, but today it's my turn because the story does involve football, or at least it's football adjacent, because it begins with a football match in Budapest the weekend before last. Greece v Hungary, it was an international friendly, and I can't tell you much more about the match apart from that some men kicked a ball and then Hungary won, 2-1.
You're fired as football correspondent, officially.
That's fine by me. But the controversy isn't so much over the match itself. It's about what Viktor Orban, the Hungarian Prime Minister, wore at the match. Because he was photographed wearing a scarf in the Hungarian colours, red, green and white, so far so uncontroversial. The problem was this little outline of Hungary that you can see on the scarf, and specifically the fact that the shape of Hungary does not match the shape of Hungary's existing borders.
Does it, by any chance, show a Hungary that is bigger than its existing borders?
How did you possibly guess that? It shows Hungary as it was before 1920, when Hungary included some bits of land that are now in Austria, Croatia, Romania, Serbia, Slovakia, and Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. And how did all those countries react to Orban wearing this scarf?
Not great, as you can imagine, because the leader of a country wearing a map that shows a version of his country with other countries' land added to it, it sends quite a strong message of, you know, wouldn't it be nice if these were still our borders kind of thing? So that is unnerving for Hungary's neighbours, especially for Ukraine. Ukraine really does not need another neighbour looking in its land and laying any kind of claim to it. Mm. So the Ukrainian government got pretty mad about this. They have summoned the Hungarian ambassador to Kiev and demanded an official apology. They're pretty mad at Orban anyway, because out of all the EU leaders, he is the most pro-Putin. The Romanian foreign ministry, meanwhile, accused Orban of revisionism. But there were two countries whose responses I particularly enjoyed. One was Austria. The foreign ministry put out a statement which basically said, Well, you know, we've been looking at a map over here, and the version of Hungary on the scarf ceased to exist 100 years ago. So we're going to give Hungary a call and let them know that. I'm paraphrasing slightly, but that was the sassy sentiment. And the other reaction that I enjoyed was from the Slovakian Prime Minister, Eduard Heger. He was photographed giving Orban a new football scarf, a Slovakian one, which I think is quite a classy way of dealing with it. It's a discreet way of saying, your last scarf sucked. You should wear this one instead.
Presumably Orban knew what he was doing, right?
Oh, yeah.
He didn't just like put on the wrong scarf and was like, oops. It's got the wrong map on it.
No, definitely not. This map is something that he has raised quite often since he became leader. But yeah, he's rejected all the criticism over this and defended himself by saying that the Hungarian football team is the team of all Hungarians, regardless of where they live. And without excusing this at all, that is quite an interesting part of the context if you want to better understand what the deal is around this map. This treaty in 1920, the Treaty of Trianon, it was a really traumatic moment in Hungary's history, in Central Europe's history. It was just after World War I. Austria-Hungary had just collapsed as a state. And all of these borders in Central Europe ended up shifting. Hungary lost like 2/3 of its territory. And millions of people who spoke the Hungarian language and thought of themselves as Hungarians ended up on the non-Hungarian side of the new borders. And even today, there's an estimated 2 million ethnic Hungarians, people who speak Hungarian at home, living in neighboring countries. And this sense of a Hungarian identity that goes beyond the modern borders is something that Orban has really sought to harness. One of the first things that he did when he came to power in 2010 was to create a new Memorial Day for the anniversary of the treaty on June the 4th. And whenever he's trying to cast Western Europe in a bad light, he's often referred to this treaty as, you know, like evidence of Western European governments being out to get Hungary. Orban also, interestingly, gave the right to citizenship to ethnic Hungarians living in neighboring countries. And lots of them ended up voting for him, which is pretty handy. Mm. And even though it's not like most Hungarians want to change the current borders, this loss of territory is still quite an important historical moment in the public imagination for a lot of Hungarians, on the right especially, and on the far right, definitely. But, you know, even beyond those kind of voters, it's been quite a powerful thing for Orban to have in his, like, his populist rhetorical arsenal. You know, it's really powerful for him to be able to refer to this really defining moment in Hungarian history and say, I am going to restore the greatness that we lost at that moment, kind of thing.
Mm.
So yeah, anyway, that's the story behind Scarfgate. I went down a bit of a rabbit hole, but I hope it was interesting.
Yeah, definitely. And Grim.
You're welcome. Who's had a good week?
It's been a good week for people in France who don't want to have fun with their colleagues.
That's me.
After a court in France ruled that one man, referred to as Mr. T, was wrongfully dismissed for not taking part in after-work drinks and team-building activities. So it's a victory for everyone out there like Katie, who doesn't like their colleagues. Move to France and your right not to have to pretend to have fun with them will be defended.
Can I just clarify, you and the people who make this podcast are now basically my only colleagues, but when I worked in a French office, I was a good participant in work drinks.
That's good to know. And actually, I wanted to ask you, are there any idiosyncrasies about how people socialize around work in France? Do you think, like, compared to other places you've worked, is there more pressure to socialize with your colleagues?
I'd say less. And that's why I found this story kind of interesting, because I don't know if it's just that I've lived a very sheltered French life, but yeah, generally I found the office culture like way less boozy here than either the UK or Hong Kong, where I lived before.
Mm.
I mean, in the UK, it's very normal for people to get absolutely steaming drunk with their colleagues. In my French office, there was a lot of like pots de départ, which are leaving drinks, but they were pretty tame.
Oh, interesting. That might explain why the courts decided to side with this guy. And maybe if a case like this came up in the UK, the courts would be more like, no, just go down to the pub with them. Get on with it.
That's lads.
But anyway, I actually quite like socializing with my colleagues. I think it makes work more fun for me personally. But it obviously depends who your colleagues are. And not everyone can have fun trying on Korean face sheet masks with their colleague like you and I do, Katie, when we see each other.
That's what we do.
But back to the case of Mr. T, he had initially lost his case in the lower Parisian court, but the Court of Cassation, which is the highest court, they actually ended up siding with Mr. T after all. And I have to say, when I heard about this, I was a bit kind of surprised that the lower court hadn't sided with him, because it seems like quite clear cut that a company shouldn't be able to fire someone for not joining in on the fun bits. Surely that's not necessary for someone to do their job.
Especially if they're being fired because it was really boozy, which I think was kind of the case here, right?
Yes, although I should say what the company, this consultancy firm, Cubic Partners, said. According to Business Insider, the company told the court that he was fired for professional incompetence. Mm-hmm. And they did specifically refer to his refusal to adhere to the company's quote-unquote fun values. But he was also accused of being difficult to work with and a poor listener. Brutal.
I'm very intrigued by these fun values. I was reading some of the French reporting on this, and they use the word fun in English, which
really
suggests that it doesn't exist in French. I'm joking. Obviously, my adopted nation is a very fun country.
Yeah, I was intrigued too. I was hoping that it was just going to be like visits to water parks or company chess tournaments. But yeah, it does sound like it was a bit more basic than that. And Mr. T's argument in court was that a lot of the fun was just, quote, excessive alcoholism encouraged by colleagues who made very large quantities of alcohol available. Mm. He also went on to say it included practices pushed by colleagues involving promiscuity, bullying, and incitement to various excesses.
Sounds like Wolf of Wall Street or something.
Yeah, it does. And actually, in the court's ruling, they describe some quite awful sounding things, including humiliating and intrusive practices. And it does seem that one person's fun values could be at the expense of another person's humiliation, perhaps. Mm. And so the recent news was that the Court of Appeals agreed with him. He had no professional obligation to join in on the so-called fun. The court ruled that by dismissing him, Cubic Partners were not respecting Mr. T's freedom of expression and ordered Cubic Partners to pay him €3,000.
That doesn't actually sound like that much money for unfair dismissal.
Yeah, I don't actually know what is standard in France, but I do know that Mr. T was initially asking for over €460,000 in damages.
Wow.
When he first took the company to court. And that still could happen. Apparently, this initial figure is just the start. And now the court will look into exactly what figure in damages they think he should be owed. So it's definitely a good week for Mr. T, but I do also feel a bit sorry for him with this case, especially now it's got all this media coverage from tabloid newspapers describing him as winning the right to be boring. I fear that he is just experiencing yet more humiliation, which was one of the reasons why he didn't want to go to these after-work events. Mm. It's one of those stories that looks like such a fun headline, and then when you dig a bit deeper, it just gets like sadder and sadder.
Trust you to turn this light-hearted good week into the most miserable story of all time.
It's my speciality. Obviously, if he manages to get hundreds of thousands in damages, I won't feel so sorry for him. But let's all agree to be kind to our colleagues who don't want to join in the so-called fun or want to have fun in a different way to the rest of the group. It's really not necessary to do your job. Maybe he should come and work with me, because not only did we go to a water park this week, but we also spent our one free evening in Tallinn in our apartment playing the 5-second drawing game.
I love that game.
So do I. And Mr. T would be very welcome to join us.
Oh. I saw my brother last week and he was like, I've been enjoying the podcast, but you do ask people for money a lot. And he's right. We ask our listeners every week if they might be able to dig deep and help us fund the show. And we don't like doing it, but we really do have to. Our show is completely independent. It has no big media backing, no structural funding. And we're here because of the generous listeners who chip in so that we can pay our producers and keep making this podcast. But I do want to say that people do get something back from chipping in. Not only the warm glow of knowing that you've done something super generous, but also, if you're able to chip in $5 a month, you get a personalized voice message from Dominic and me. That would make a great gift for a fan of the podcast if you fancy signing up on their behalf sometime before Christmas. And we are also, week after next, doing something that we've never done before and inviting our supporters to sit in on the recording of our Christmas episode on December 12th.
Yeah, it's rather terrifying. I'm a bit scared about having people take a peek behind the curtain on how this show is made.
It's probably a terrible idea.
I'm also happy we're going to get to make an episode where we can see so many of you all over the world whilst we're recording, and even maybe hear from some of you. So yeah, this is a good time to head over to patreon.com/Europeans podcast. Maybe your brother should do it too, Katie.
Yeah, maybe you should, Dave.
Thanks, Dave.
This week we have three people to thank in particular, as well as my brother Dave, who's about to sign up. They are Helenka Kinnan, Pat Bader for increasing her pledge, and the magnificently named Wibbly Wobbly Wonder.
Great name.
I think that's an Irish ice cream from the 70s.
Oh, good reference.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Irish listeners, but I heard about that randomly on the podcast.
Thank you all of you for that lovely birthday present.
A couple of months ago, some very strange reports started surfacing about quote-unquote Chinese overseas police stations being set up in Europe. Their existence was first flagged up by an NGO called Safeguard Defenders. It's based in Spain, but focuses on supporting human rights activists in Asia. And it was pretty unclear what was going on at these sites. But the one thing that we did know is that the countries hosting them, countries including the Netherlands and Ireland and Spain, the governments of these countries didn't seem to know about these sites. They were unauthorized. Which begs the question, what the hell is going on here? Honestly, I haven't been sure what to make of this story. If you, like me, are someone who is interested in China, you also probably, like me, had immediate alarm bells ringing. Like, what is going on at these sites? How worried should we be about them? Is it possible that they're being used, for example, to put pressure on dissidents that have fled China for political reasons? We thought it was about time we rang up someone who thinks a lot about how China operates beyond its borders. She has done some great reporting on this story. Yuan Yang, she is China Europe correspondent for the Financial Times newspaper, and we gave her a ring in London.
Could you start by telling us a bit about the scale of what this Spanish NGO Safeguard Defenders have uncovered and how many of these quote-unquote secret police service stations there are?
Yes. So a few months ago, the NGO Safeguard Defenders put out a report which basically drew on the Chinese media reporting that's already in the public domain about these so-called overseas service stations. So there have been a few different local police bureaus in China. And when we say local, we're talking about at the level of a city or a county, not a national scale endeavor at all. But these local police forces had this initiative to set up overseas service stations across the world. Many of them are in Europe. And there are about 30 of these stations so far that we've heard of through Chinese media reporting on the stations.
I wanted to ask about the fact that these are locally run. What should we make of that?
So I think the local slash national nature of Chinese policymaking is really fascinating, and it really comes out in this example of the police stations, because when we asked the Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs about the police stations, they seemed to be really caught off guard. The first time we spoke to them, they were a bit like, oh yeah, I don't know where you're getting this information from. We need to look into it. These aren't associated with us. And as we saw over the last few weeks, as more and more media have covered the story, the foreign ministry has had to kind of shore up its line on what it's saying about these police stations. It's saying that they're not a national initiative and that it was not aware of the police stations being set up. So in a way, this showcases a quite common feature of Chinese politics, which is that there is a very large distance between the central government in Beijing and all the different local bureaus. I think it's very easy for observers outside of China to see the Chinese government as a monolith. But once you kind of look under the cover, it's actually extremely complicated and extremely uncoordinated. At the central level, there has been a push from the central police to try to extend more of their work outside of China, and in particular to try to increase the rate of fugitives abroad being brought back to China. That push is then trickling down into local police forces who are then saying, okay, so we've been given this direction. We haven't been given a clear set of policies, but we do know where the overall wind is blowing. Now, how do we manage to show off our achievements and do the things that we are guessing our superiors want us to do? And then there's a lot of innovation of sometimes quite random policies at the grassroots level that happens.
And how much do we know about what has actually been going on at these sites, the kind of tasks that they've been giving themselves?
So very few verified stories about what's going on. The main source of information we have about these stations is what's been written about them in the Chinese state media. Mm. And that, of course, is what the police themselves have been saying. So when we read Chinese media, when we read state media in particular, we have to bear in mind that the state media is a mouthpiece of government agencies. So we have to take things with a pinch of salt. So the two kinds of examples of stories that the local police forces have themselves been telling state media fall into two categories. And the first is the biggest, which is helping overseas Chinese citizens with paperwork and bureaucracy. And bearing in mind that China is an incredibly bureaucratic place, a lot of processes, you have to go not just to a police station, but to the police station of your hometown, where you have your so-called household registration or hukou registration in order to get them done, whether it's a marriage certificate or whether it's a property deed. These are the kinds of paperwork processes that the police themselves say that they're doing for citizens abroad in these overseas police stations. Now, you might ask, why aren't these being done by the consulates? Because in a normal situation, that is what we'd expect the embassies and consulates to be doing for their Chinese citizens. And I think this is a messy situation where the local police think that they have jurisdiction or think that they have responsibility to deal with certain issues. And the other side of what it's doing, according to the police stations themselves, is to use these stations and use the volunteers that staff them to try to persuade, which is a very euphemistic term, to persuade people who've been accused of criminal acts in China to return to China. This is in the context of a broader set of campaigns that the Chinese government has been enacting to try to persuade both high-level, you know, political targets, corrupt ministers, etc., to return to China, and also kind of petty white-collar crime, telecoms fraud and online scams, these kinds of people to return to China. This second basket of cases falls under extraterritorial policing and the ambition that China has to extend its policing influence outside of its borders.
And that is the bit that so many European governments are so worried about. How have European governments been responding to this reporting, and can these outposts be shut down? Will they be shut down?
Of course, there's been a great deal of alarm. The Dutch government, the Irish government have already started looking into the stations and shutting them down. Other governments across Europe have also said that they are surprised and shocked by the report and that they are investigating the stations. I think the stations themselves are really a symptom rather than necessarily the root issue when it comes to extraterritorial policing. I mean, the physical locations themselves are usually quite minimal. They're often the registered premises of a restaurant, or sometimes it's a business association. You know, these are not police stations in the way that we think of a police station with a bunch of officers in uniform who are patrolling and who are carrying out routine tasks. They're really more like shell addresses, shell organizations. So I think the police stations, the physical locations themselves, are not really where the action is. I think what we'll increasingly see over the next decade is China's ambitions to increase the reach of its extradition laws and also to increase the reach of its, let's say, kind of extra legal influence into policing in Europe and in the rest of the world.
I guess the thing I'm struggling with is how sinister to think this is. Because, I mean, if it is a question of them, you know, using these sites to help Chinese citizens with paperwork, that's one thing.
Yeah.
When you hear the phrase overseas police stations, and if you are someone who is interested in China, you think of it as potentially fitting into this pattern of China exerting control over members of the diaspora and this idea that dissidents might not be safe. Mm. I mean, does it fit into that existing pattern of China surveilling and trying to control members of the diaspora, or do we just really not know?
I think that these are parallel issues that you're discussing, the control of the Chinese diaspora and then what these so-called police service stations are trying to do. I think there is a threat to Chinese overseas diaspora from Chinese government attempts to influence, on attempts to infiltrate and to surveil and monitor what diaspora individuals are doing outside of China, particularly, for example, Hong Kong protesters in the UK. We've seen incidents even of consulate violence against Hong Kong protesters. And that kind of work is coordinated by the United Front, which is a central Communist Party committee. These police stations, I think, they originate from a separate agency to the United Front work. I think they're more focused, at least in terms of what their stated aims, on one, the paperwork, on two, the pressuring fugitives to return. We also have to bear in mind, when we say fugitives, to quote Peter Darlin, the founder of Safeguard Defenders, the NGO that wrote the report, you know, some of these people are bad people, some of these people are good people, some of them, you know, we don't know. Where China does not have an extradition agreement with, say, a specific European country, and instead is using pressure and intimidation to force that person person to leave that country and come back to China, that's a rule of law issue. Some of these people have been committing huge amounts of telecoms fraud and stealing money off pensioners back in China. They've then left the country. And yes, China, like any large developed country, needs to have a process of being able to return criminals to justice so that people can't keep on preying on its citizens just by leaving the country. And at the same time, quite rightly, European governments are now increasingly suspicious of extradition to China because they're concerned that once they extradite somebody from Europe, that person will not have any fair due process in China and is at risk of torture and is at risk of other human rights abuses once going back into the Chinese criminal justice system. And that's what's led to the recent European Court of Human Rights ruling to prevent the extradition of one Taiwanese citizen in Poland from being extradited to mainland China on accusations of telecoms fraud. And yes, this individual, we don't know if they have committed that fraud or if they're innocent. But what we do know is that the Chinese prosecution system has a 99% success rate of prosecution. And that 99% rate will include people who have been tortured and who have confessed to crimes that they haven't committed.
There do seem to be more of these police service stations sites in Europe than anywhere else. Although there does seem to have been some set up in the Americas, in Africa and Asia. Why might the Chinese authorities be so interested in setting up the sites here in Europe?
I think that's a really interesting question. If you go to the story that we wrote in the FT about the police stations, we have a map of where the stations are. And there are lots and lots of them in Europe, particularly in Spain and in Central and Eastern Europe. I think this really follows the spread of migration from the specific hometowns that the police stations come from. So the two major sources of these overseas police service stations are Fuzhou, which is a city that's on the southeast coast of China, very close to Taiwan. And a lot of people from that region left, you know, a generation ago to do business outside. It's kind of very well known as like a merchant hotspot. There's a lot of international trade and business. And then the other part of China where these service stations have come from is called Qingtian, which is on the eastern coast, not that far from Shanghai in terms of locating this place. So I think a lot of the stations have been set up with the help of these overseas hometown associations. And then those hometown associations and those police forces back in China will try to choose cities where they've had a large flux of immigrants.
I think your job title is really fascinating. You were previously a correspondent in Beijing, and I think you've only been covering this more specific beat of the relationship between China and Europe for a few months now.
That's right, yes.
How have you found it so far? And what are the main issues that you think are going to be keeping you busy?
Covering Europe-China, I think, is really interesting because, unlike the US, there's such a diversity of views and approaches within Europe of how to engage with China, how to deal with Chinese businesses. And I think we're really very much at a turning point in Europe-China relations. I think Germany is a very key player here in terms of a country that's had so much business investment in China. I think there's now an increasing sense that the era of completely free trade with China is over, that it's not delivered the same kinds of reciprocity and access for European companies as they'd hoped when they started engaging with China a generation ago. And that something needs to change now in the relationship, particularly in the wake of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which demonstrated to many European businesses how dependent they were on supplies from a country that was not a political ally and that they maybe should not have been so reliant on in the beginning for energy. And that question mark around dependency and how do we start to diversify away from countries that we don't think are going to be reliable partners is also the main frame that I see the discussion with China.
Thank you so much to Yuan for joining us. She is a great person to follow on Twitter if you are interested in the ups and downs of China-Europe relations and China in general. She has, as you might expect, been writing about the extraordinary protests that we've seen flaring up around China over the past week or so. So quick, go follow Yuan on Twitter while that website still exists. What have you been enjoying this week?
I have been watching the second season of The White Lotus. Have you seen it?
Oh, no, but I loved the first series and I heard about the second series.
Yeah, it's this HBO comedy drama about the guests and employees at a luxurious fictional hotel resort chain. And the first season was set in their resort in Hawaii. It was an absolute hoot. And I can finally talk about the series on this European podcast because the second season is set in Sicily. If you, like me and Katie, were obsessed with all the hilarious, infuriating, yet pretty believable characters in season one, you have to get over the fact that mainly they are not here in season two, with the exception of Tonya, played by the iconic Jennifer Coolidge.
She's incredible.
I've only seen a few episodes so far because they're releasing them old school, one by one each week. But I'm completely obsessed and love all the new characters, especially this edgy Italian hotel manager woman. Sicily looks so beautiful, and I imagine they're going to get a bit of a tourism boost after this series, even if everyone staying at the hotel in the series is having a pretty awful time. I really highly recommend it.
I read this Twitter thread. There was this guy complaining about the portrayal of Americans in this show because they never seem to leave the hotel. It's like, why would you go all the way to Sicily and then just like eat in the hotel and stay in the hotel? And then someone had replied to him like, that's the whole point. These are supposed to be the absolute worst type of tourist.
Yeah, exactly. What have you been enjoying?
I have been very much enjoying The Playlist on Netflix. Have you heard about it?
No.
So it is a Swedish miniseries that recreates the founding of Spotify, which is of course a Swedish company. And I found myself surprisingly gripped by it. I guess you can see it as part of this tradition of like tech biopics, telling the story of like Facebook or Apple. And these films tend to be quite formulaic in terms of having a nerdy anti-hero who ends up building a massive company. Mm. And The Playlist does have elements of that. Daniel Ek, the CEO of Spotify, is very much portrayed as a visionary nerd who sees how the internet can revolutionize some aspects of our lives. And then he goes ahead and does it. But the thing that I really like about the show, and I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to tell you this, is that each episode tells the story of Spotify from a different perspective, like from the perspective of someone different who was involved in the founding of the company. And you would think that that would get boring, hearing it over and over again. But actually, I haven't found it boring. Maybe just because I'm someone who's interested in how artists get paid for their music. I don't know. I was also worried that they weren't really going to address this issue of a lot of musicians getting screwed by the way that money from streaming gets distributed, but they do talk about that. Mm. So yeah, if you are interested in how the music industry works, or if you fancy a trip down memory lane into the era of illegal downloading in the mid-noughties, I think you'll enjoy this. It's called The Playlist and it's on Netflix.
Time for a happy ending. Many of us dream of being astronauts when we're kids, and not many of us actually get there. But this week, the European Space Agency, the ESA, announced the latest 17 lucky recruits to be accepted into their prestigious astronaut training program. And amongst the 17 people selected for this two-year scheme is John McFall, a 41-year-old guy from Britain and an ex-Paralympic athlete. He won a bronze medal at the Paralympics in 2008, and with McFall's acceptance onto the program, he will become the first person with a disability to receive astronaut training, the world's first para-astronaut. He will be working with the ESA and NASA on a feasibility study to work out how to make it possible for someone with a disability to go into space. It might not mean that McFall himself will actually end up in space, but it could do. And whatever happens, it's a big step for the ESA. And the ESA said to the BBC that they did it because they wanted to expand the definition of what it meant to have the quote-unquote right stuff to go into space. I think it's very exciting news.
Very exciting news. Did you see who else got accepted to that program?
Yes. I wanted to say that before we move on from the new astronauts, I wanted to send big congratulations to a friend, former guest and listener of this podcast who was also accepted into the ESA's astronauts program this week as a reserve astronaut, the atmospheric physicist, Dr. Megan Christian. You may remember that we spoke to her in an episode called The Most Isolated Place on Earth. At that point, she was living in this French-Italian scientific base in the Arctic. I actually listened back to the episode on the way back from Tallinn yesterday, and it's a really fun interview. She's such a cool person, and I'm really not surprised she got into this program because she's so clever. And also because being on that Arctic base, as we discussed in the interview, is really kind of similar to being in space because it's so isolated. So congrats, Megan. Come back and speak to us in a bit and tell us what life is like as an astronaut.
Maybe if she ends up going, she can talk to us from space.
That would be so cool.
That is it for this week. If you are craving more Europe in your ears and you haven't heard it already, check out last week's episode because it was a bumper one. Almost a full hour of us wittering on about how Europe has changed over the past 5 years. You can also find us on the social medias. We are on Twitter at EuropeansPod and Instagram at EuropeansPodcast.
This podcast is part of the Are We Europe audio family. Go and check out their beautiful magazines at areweeurope.eu.
Have a great week, everyone.
Hüvasti.
Bis lad.